This is March 14th. 13th. All right, March 13th, 2016. And special shout out to people who are listening to this live. This is our first stab at live streaming things from the Zendo here. We're starting today and hope to do the same for the evening sittings at least. Starting tomorrow evening, hearing live streaming of silence is, some may say, is leaves something to be desired. But it won't be entirely silence. It'll be for the sittings. It'll be the bells, the sound of the stick. It's a way of inviting out-of-town people into the Zendo. If it can help ever so slightly to get people to sit on their own at home by synchronizing their sitting with our sittings, then it's just a win-win situation. Doesn't cost us anything, and it's wonderful to think of those of you who are listening live right now in your homes. I'm going to tackle an article from the Washington Post from quite a while ago, the year 2007. And it's about kind of an absolutely fascinating, maybe social psychology experiment in real life, real time, about a great violinist, Joshua Bell, playing in the subway, and what kind of response he got. I know this was the subject, this article was used for a Dharma talk many years ago, and which I never heard, but I figured that with the passage of 9 years, I could have a stab at it myself and make some comments on it from a Zen or Buddhist point of view. I've been, even then, when it was used for the Dharma talk, I was gearing up for a Taisho, and then I had to give it some time before I try it myself. So, unfortunately, the author, the journalist who wrote this long article, his or her name must have been in color because it didn't come out here on the and the printout copy I have. So, Washington Post, April 8th, 2007. The name of the article is Pearls Before Breakfast. Can one of the nation's great musicians cut through the fog of a DC rush hour? Let's find out. So first I'll read the first page. I'll be reading less than a third of this article because it is so long, but I want to set the stage here, literally the stage. So it begins. He emerged from the metro at the L'Enfant Plaza station and positioned himself against a wall beside a trash basket. By most measures, he was nondescript. A youngish white man in jeans, a long-sleeved t-shirt, and a Washington Nationals baseball cap. From a small case, he removed a violin. Placing the open case at his feet, he shrewdly threw in a few dollars in pocket change as seed money, swiveled it to face pedestrian traffic, and began to play. It was 7:51 a.m. on Friday, January 12th, the middle of the morning rush hour. In the next 43 minutes, as the violinist performed six classical pieces, 1,097 people passed by. Almost all of them were on their way to work, which meant, for almost all of them, a government job. L'Enfant Plaza is at the nucleus of federal Washington, and these were mostly middle-level bureaucrats with those indeterminate, oddly fungible titles: policy analyst, project manager, budget officer, specialist, facilitator, consultant. Each passerby had a quick choice to make, one familiar to commuters in any urban area where the occasional street performer is part of the cityscape. Do you stop and listen? Do you hurry past with a blend of guilt and irritation, aware of your cupidity, but annoyed by the unbidden demand on your time and your wallet? Do you throw in a buck just to be polite? Does your decision change if he's really bad? What if he's really good? Do you have time for beauty? Shouldn't you? What's the moral mathematics of the moment? On that Friday in January, those private questions would be answered in an unusually public way. No one knew it, but the fiddler, standing against a bare wall outside the metro in an indoor arcade at the top of the escalators, was one of the finest classical musicians in the world, playing some of the most elegant music ever written on one of the most valuable violins ever made. His performance was arranged by the Washington Post as an experiment in context, perception, and priorities, as well as an unblinking assessment of public taste. In a banal setting at an inconvenient time, would beauty transcend? The musician did not play popular tunes whose familiarity alone might have drawn interest. That was not the test. These were masterpieces that have endured for centuries on their brilliance alone, soaring music befitting the grandeur of cathedrals and concert halls. And the author mentions that she says the acoustics proved surprisingly kind. Skipping here, the violin is an instrument that is said to be much like the human voice, and in this musician's masterly hands, it sobbed and laughed and sang, ecstatic, sorrowful, importuning, adoring, flirtatious, castigating, playful, romancing, merry, triumphal, sumptuous. So, what do you think happened? Before we get to that, a little bit about Joshua Bell. Mentions that he was a child prodigy, and at his age, at the time of this article, at this the time of this experiment, he was 39 and had arrived as an internationally acclaimed virtuoso. 3 days before he appeared at the metro station, Bell had filled the house at Boston's stately Symphony Hall, where merely pretty good seats went for $100. And then it talks more about his remarkable fame and ability, his awards and so forth. By the way, at the end, the very end of the article, on the final paragraph is, Bell headed off on a concert tour of European capitals. But he's back in the States this week. He has to be. On Tuesday, he will be accepting the Avery Fisher Prize, recognizing the flop of the L'Enfant Plaza. That is a tip-off about how he was received in the subway as the best classical musician in America. So when the Washington Post pitched this idea to him, it says here, when Bell was asked if he'd be willing to don street clothes and perform at rush hour, he said, a stunt? Well, yes, a stunt. Would he think it unseemly? Bell drained his cup. Sounds like fun, he said. And then it talks about how good looking he is and charismatic and have to skip all that. And his violin, it goes on at great length about his violin, which was reported to have been, he's reported to have spent $3.5 million on. He had to sell his own Stradivarius and borrow much of the rest of the money to buy his, the one he was using at this subway station. It was only 3 blocks from his apartment, but he took a cab to not risk something happening to this instrument. It also describes more the nature, describes this subway station where he's playing. At the top of the escalators are a shoeshine stand, we'll return to that later, and a busy kiosk that sells newspapers, lottery tickets, and a wall full of magazines. I'm just going to say she, as far as referring to the journalist. I don't know. Let's make it a she. On Friday, January 12th, this is the journalist speaking. On Friday, January 12th, the people waiting in the lottery line looking for a long shot would get a lucky break, a free close-up ticket to a concert by one of the world's most famous musicians, but only if they were of a mind to take note. Bell decided to begin with Chacon from Bach. Bell calls it not just one of the greatest pieces of music ever written, but one of the greatest achievements of any person in history. It's a spiritually powerful piece, emotionally powerful, structurally perfect. Plus, it was written for a solo violin, so I won't be cheating with some half-assed version. There's a lot more about this piece, Chacon, but I don't have time to go on with that. So that's the piece he started with. And then we'll pick up where the journalist writes here. He'd clearly meant it when he promised not to cheap out this performance. He played with acrobatic enthusiasm, his body leaning into the music and arching on tiptoes at the high notes. He's, by the way, been criticized by some as being kind of a drama queen, the way he plays. The sound was nearly symphonic, carrying to all parts of the homely arcade as the pedestrian traffic filed past. 3 minutes went by before something happened. 63 people had already passed when, finally, there was a breakthrough of sorts. A middle-aged man altered his gait for a split second, turning his head to notice that there seemed to be some guy playing music. Yes, the man kept walking, but it was something. A half minute later, Bell got his first donation. A woman threw in a buck and scooted off. It was not until 6 minutes into the performance that someone actually stood against a wall and listened. We'll come back to that guy a little bit later. Things never got much better. In the 3/4 of an hour that Joshua Bell played, 7 people stopped what they were doing to hang around and take in the performance, at least for a minute. 27 gave money, and most of them on the run, for a total of $32 and change. He mentions later in the article that he has played for $1,000 a minute. That leaves the 1,070 people who hurried by, oblivious, many only 3 feet away, few even turning to look. It was all videotaped by a hidden camera. You can play the recording once or 15 times, and it never gets any easier to watch. Try speeding it up, and it becomes one of those herky-jerky World War I-era silent newsreels. The people scurry by in comical little hops and starts, cups of coffee in their hands, cell phones at their ears, ID tags slapping at their bellies, a grim dons macabre to indifference, inertia, and the dingy gray rush of modernity. Even at this accelerated pace, though, the fiddler's movements remain fluid and graceful. He seems so apart from his audience, unseen, unheard, otherworldly, that you find yourself thinking that he's not really there, a ghost. Only then do you see it. He is the one who is real. They are the ghosts. Ghosts, inasmuch as they're so lost in thought that their perceptions are blocked. And this is something we all can appreciate, that to the degree that we are lost in our cloud of daydreams or thoughts, we will miss what's happening. To the degree that we're absent-minded, we'll be absent. We won't be there. We won't be here. We miss a lot. And there is something ghost-like about us when we are lost in thought. This is aside from when we need to be thinking about something. There's a place for thinking. I love Roshi Kaplow's distinction between thinking and thoughting. Thinking is something, as human beings, we have some responsibility even to do. It's our very special endowment to apply to problems our superior intellects. But thoughting is the real problem from a Zen perspective. It's where we're just awash in random, irrelevant, disconnected thoughts that keep us separated from where we are and whom we're with. The next section, she calls it, the title is, "If a great musician plays great music, but no one hears, was he really any good?" Then she goes into, that's a play on the old philosophical question, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, did it make any sound? And by the way, when that question, which philosophers have debated for centuries, when that question was put to Yasutani Roshi, his answer was, no. Oh, and then she gets into Kant's theories and what is beauty? The journalist asked, is it a measurable fact or merely an opinion, or is it a little of each colored by the immediate state of mind of the observer? That's that last one she attributes to Kant, colored by the immediate state of mind of the observer. Now, this is where we get into the very core of Buddhist teaching and the experience of Buddhism, the experience of enlightenment, which is that there can be no such thing as, well, let's say I take a concept like beauty. What does beauty mean? It of course depends on the perceiver, as well as the object, the musical piece or the painting or the sculpture. This is a fundamental teaching of the Dharma, is we'll call dependent co-arising. That nothing exists in and of itself. We can't talk about beauty or truth without considering the subject as well as the object. It doesn't make sense. Or other examples of dependent co-arising. We can't talk about the, let's say, the merits or the abilities of a teacher. Let's make it a school teacher. The merits or abilities of a school teacher, because it depends on the student. We tend to, there may be, you know, they have these awards they give, Teacher of the Year and all, and there is surely some, to a degree, you can speak about the skills of a teacher, but the effectiveness of a teacher is dependent on not just her or his skills, but the match between that teacher and that student. Or let's talk about presidential campaigns. We can't really talk about the value of a candidate apart from those who give him or her value, the supporters. This is they co-arise. The Trump phenomena. I've never been nearly as interested in him as a megalomaniac as much as by those who support him. That's what's intriguing. The number of people who see him as the answer to our country's problems. He doesn't exist in a vacuum. There's no Trump or Cruz or Clinton or Sanders apart from those who validate these candidates. And then you can just go on and on through everything, everything in our life. In one set of conditions, a politician or a teacher or a chef or an athlete will distinguish himself and be regarded, admired, and respected. In another, not so much. This experiment in the DC subway, it would be very different if you structured it so that outdoors you had commuters rushing to work past something visually thrilling, like a Federer or a Djokovic playing tennis. I'm convinced they would not just walk by and oblivious to what's happening. So there's a difference also with the senses. Later on, it says that with Chacon, the opening is filled with a building sense of awe. That kept him busy, Bell. It kept Bell busy for a while. Eventually, though, he began to steal a sidelong glance. It was a strange feeling that people were actually, the word doesn't come easily, ignoring me. Bell is laughing. It's at himself. And then Bell continues, at a music hall, I'll get upset if someone coughs or if someone's cell phone goes off. But here, my expectations quickly diminished. I started to appreciate any acknowledgement, even a slight glance up. I was oddly grateful when someone threw in a dollar instead of change. This is from a man whose talents can command $1,000 a minute. Before he began, Bell hadn't known what to expect. What he does know is that, for some reason, he was nervous. It wasn't exactly stage fright, but there were butterflies, he says. I was stressing a little. Bell has played literally before crowned heads of Europe. Why the anxiety at the Washington Metro? And then Bell explains, when you play for ticket holders, you are already validated. I have no sense that I need to be accepted. I'm already accepted. Here, there was this thought, what if they don't like me? What if they resent my presence? He was, in short, art without a frame. Here, some more of the Buddhist experience, which is coming to understand that that how we frame our experiences or people or things, how we conceptually frame them, can make all the difference in our experience of them. A world of difference. What many of these commuters may have been doing is designating him in their mind as, a subway musician, blah, there. And once you diminish someone conceptually like that, and this is what we always have to be aware of that we may be doing to people and things, once we diminish a person or thing or experience conceptually, then we're not perceiving it as it is. So we know this happens in terms of anyone we perceive as other, someone of another race. Oh, it's just a black person, or it's just a white person, or just an Asian person. We do this, people, our ethnic concepts of people. We do this in nature. Oh, it's just a blade of grass. That's not how Walt Whitman, that's not what he was doing, or William Blake. They had no frame around the blade of grass, or a flower, or a falling leaf, or snow falling. And this is where meditation comes in. Zen and other kinds of meditation is we are in Zen, at least, we are trying to not put a more beautiful frame on things, because that's not necessary. We're trying to get rid of all frames, or we could call them filters, all prisms. Any way we filter and thus diminish objects or experiences, by removing that, which means detaching from our thoughts and concepts, by removing that, then we come to have the direct experience, which for anything can become exhilarating, fascinating. We know this just from facing a wall. What could be more boring on the surface of it, just looked at from the outside, than facing a blank wall? And yet, people who have had peak experiences or wonderful experiences in Zazen know that that's not the point. What we're facing, it's not the object itself. Our experience of that object, the blank wall, is entirely dependent on our mind, the mind of the perceiver, and the degree to which that mind is clouded by thoughts or not. That's it. So I would say that the author is wrong in this one point, that Joshua Bell was not art without a frame. He was art with the wrong frame, but that any frame, in a sense, would be the wrong frame. And children, they're young enough, haven't yet formed these conceptual frames or concepts about things and people, and that's what enables them to see things freshly. And that's what we're going to get into in a minute, is about how the children responded to Joshua Bell. The journalist here interviews a Mark Lighthouser, who is the senior curator at the National Gallery in Washington. And she says, Lighthouser thinks he has some idea of what happened at that metro station. And then I have to skip over this. He basically says, yeah, it depends on how we see it, how we frame the experience. She refers to it, the journalist refers to it as context. Lighthouser's point is that we shouldn't be too ready to label the metro passersby unsophisticated boobs. Context matters. And then she comes back to Kant. Kant said the same thing. The 18th century German philosopher felt that to properly appreciate beauty, the viewing conditions must be optimal. Optimal doesn't mean heading to work, focusing on your report to the boss, maybe your shoes don't fit right. So, if Kant had been at the Metro watching as Joshua Bell play to 1,000 unimpressed passersby, this guy, who is this guy? Anyway, someone else, he would have inferred about them absolutely nothing. And that's that. Except it isn't, she continues. To really understand what happened, you have to rewind that video and play it back from the beginning, from the moment Bell's bow first touched the strings. White guy, khakis, leather jacket, briefcase, early 30s. John David Mortensen is on the final leg of his daily bus to Metro commute from Reston. He's heading up the escalator. It's a long ride, 1 minute and 15 seconds if you don't walk. So, like most everyone who passes Bell this day, Mortensen gets a good earful of music before he has his first look at the musician. Remember, the musician, Bell, is at the top, the upper floor. Like most of them, he notes that it sounds pretty good. But like very few of them, when he gets to the top, he doesn't race past as though Bell were some nuisance to be avoided. Mortensen is that first person to stop, that guy at the six-minute mark. It's not that he has nothing else to do. He's a project manager for an international program at the Department of Energy. On the video, you can see Mortensen get off the escalator and look around. He locates the violinist, stops, walks away, but then is drawn back. He checks the time on his cell phone. He's 3 minutes early for work, then settles against a wall to listen. Mortensen doesn't know classical music at all. Classic rock is as close as he comes. But there's something about what he's hearing that he really likes. So for the first time in his life, Mortensen lingers to listen to a street musician. He stays his allotted 3 minutes as 94 more people pass briskly by. When he leaves to help plan contingency budgets for the Department of Energy, there's another first. For the first time in his life, not quite knowing what had happened, but sensing it was special, John David Mortensen gives a street musician money. While I think of it, let's acknowledge that if you're rushing to work, especially if you're late, you don't have, if you're expected to be on time, you don't have the luxury of stopping for long. But as we have heard here, it's not that people don't pause and look wistfully at this great musician and wish they could spend longer. They rush by, most of them, without any apparent awareness of what's going on. But some more examples here of the few who didn't just rush by oblivious. After Chacon, it is Franz Schubert's Ave Maria. A couple of minutes into it, something revealing happens. A woman and her preschooler emerge from the escalator. The woman is walking briskly, and therefore so is the child. She's got his hand. I had a time crunch, recalls Sharon Parker, an IT director for a federal agency. I had an 8:30 training class, and first I had to rush Evie off to his teacher, then rush back to work, then to the training facility in the basement. Evie is her son, Evan. Evan is 3. You can see Evan clearly on the video. He's the cute black kid in the parka who keeps twisting around to look at Joshua Bell as he is being propelled toward the door. He clearly hasn't framed the music yet as just music by old dead white people. There was a musician, Parker says, and my son was intrigued. He wanted to pull over and listen, but I was rushed for time. So Parker does what she has to do. She deftly moves her body between Evans and Bell's, cutting off her son's line of sight. As they exit the arcade, Evan can still be seen craning to look. When Parker is told what she walked out on, she laughs. Evan is very smart, she says. Here, too, I'm not unsympathetic to the dilemma of a parent needing to get to work. There's no judgment there. Parents especially can sympathize with the plight of a parent in such a situation. Then the author continues, there was no ethnic or demographic pattern to distinguish the people who stayed to watch Bell or the ones who gave money from that vast majority who hurried on past unheeding. Whites, blacks, Asians, young and old, men and women were represented in all three groups. But the behavior of one demographic remained absolutely consistent. Every single time a child walked past, he or she tried to stop and watch, and every single time a parent scooted the kid away. Now, to be fair, just about any vivid sense experience, a kid is going to turn around and be interested in it. But it's not the kid's interest is the main point. It's everyone else's lack of interest or awareness. 100 feet away across the arcade was the lottery line. Sometimes you know what's coming here. Sometimes 5 or 6 people long. They had a much better view of Bell than anyone else if they had just turned around. But no one did. Not in the entire 43 minutes. They just shuffled forward toward that machine spitting out numbers. Eyes on the prize. And here we can see the difference between two different components of meditation, at least Zen meditation, which is the mindfulness component and the concentration component. In Zazen, in our sitting, they're both there. We want to be concentrated on the object. Our practice, the breath or the koan, we want to be absorbed in focused concentration on it. But in order to do this effectively, we have to notice when the mind has wandered. That's the mindfulness. Concentration and mindfulness. The mindfulness is essential to any form of Zen practice. We have to notice. I think it's a perfect, simple, ordinary word for mindfulness is noticing. Those people in the lottery line were so concentrated on getting up there and getting their ticket and potentially winning the lottery that the mindfulness, the awareness or noticing was cut off. And the same with the people who were rushing to get to work on time. They had that kind of tunnel vision where they needed to focus on their immediate goal. She writes, there are 6 moments in the video that Bell finds particularly painful to relive. The awkward times, he calls them. It's what happens right after each piece ends. Nothing. Mm-hmm. The music stops. The same people who hadn't noticed him playing don't notice that he has finished. No applause, no acknowledgement. So Bell just saws out a small nervous chord, the embarrassed musician's equivalent of, okay, moving right along, and begins the next piece. I've kind of adopted a policy if I'm at a restaurant or there's a live musician of when they finish clapping. Sometimes it can, I suppose to some people it's not what they would want, but why not? What do you lose by clapping? The musician can be so gratifying to the musician. And then, but the end of Ave Maria, Bell ends Ave Maria to another thunderous silence. So painful. Watching the video weeks later, Bell finds himself mystified by one thing only. He understands why he's not drawing a crowd in the rush of a morning workday, but, quote, I'm surprised at the number of people who don't pay attention at all. As if I'm invisible. Because you know what? I'm making a lot of noise. He is. This is the journalist. He is. You don't need to know music at all to appreciate the simple fact that there's a guy there playing a violin that's throwing out a whole bucket of sound. At times, Bell's bowing is so intricate that you seem to be hearing two instruments playing in harmony. So those head-forward, quick-stepping passers-by are a remarkable phenomenon. Bell wonders whether their inattention may be deliberate. I think this is a valid question. If you don't take visible note of the musician, you don't have to feel guilty about not forking over money. You're not complicit in a rip-off. It may be true, she says, but no one gave that explanation. People just said they were busy, had other things on their mind. Some who were on cell phones spoke louder as they passed Bell to compete with that infernal racket. Let's admit that a violin can be pretty loud. But here, this article was 9 years ago, and before 8 out of 10 people were making their way through subways and down streets and with their smartphones, with their heads stooped over their phones, lost in their device and cut off from what's going on around them. I would bet that it would be just as bad today with people's devices. This thing about invisibility, where Bell says, it's as if I'm invisible. Many of you have heard me quote a Japanese teacher in saying that, or maybe it was before him, it was a Zen saying, that nothing distinguishes the enlightened person. Let me just make that point, that there's charisma, which maybe Bell did have, it sounds like it from the description. And then there's what is beyond charisma, where there is just a transparency, an ordinariness, which is really characterizes the higher reaches of Zen attainment. Nothing special. I bet this is not what was, this was, could not have been what was the case with Joshua Bell. He's too much of a sensation. But how many of us would notice the exquisite ordinariness of a deeply enlightened person? I remember reading in the Three Pillars of Yasutani Roshi on the subways in Japan, wearing just his sneakers and most ordinary clothes. And I think it said that most people paid absolutely no notice of him. nothing special. It continues, and then there was Calvin Myint. Myint works for the General Services Administration. He got to the top of the escalator, turned right, and headed out a door to the street. A few hours later, he had no memory that there had been a musician anywhere in sight. Where was he in relation to me? About 4 feet away. Oh. There's nothing wrong with Myint's hearing. He had buds in his ear. He was listening to his iPod. For many of us, she writes, the explosion in technology has perversely limited, not expanded, our exposure to new experiences. Increasingly, we get our news from sources that think as we already do. And with iPods, we hear what we already know. We program our own playlists. And she talks about the shoeshine lady who was annoyed with Joshua Bell, or any, and whenever there's a musician, she gets annoyed because she can't do her chit-chat with her customers and make a little more money. Souza, she was from Brazil. Souza was surprised to learn he was a famous musician, but not that people rushed blindly by him. That, she said, was predictable. And then she claims, if something like this happened in Brazil, everyone would stand around to see, not here. And it may be true that in another city, I think of San Francisco, maybe the passers-by were, they had different jobs, there may be a higher hit rate of people stopping. Souza nods sourly toward a spot near the top of the escalator. A couple of years ago, a homeless guy died right there. He just lay down there and died. The police came, an ambulance came, and no one even stopped to see or slowed down to look. This is what is most distressing about this phenomenon of being oblivious to what's going on around us, is missing the opportunity to respond to someone in need. And again, there can be the element of time, and if you know that there are medical helpers there, then you can tell yourself reasonably that the person is being taken care of. But probably most people hearing this have heard of stories of people just stepping over people in the street. What have we become if we're so riveted on getting somewhere on time that we can't stop and lend a hand to someone? It's very sad. And then she quotes a W.H. Davies. What is this life if, full of care, we have no time to stand and stare? Turns out this was written by what she describes as a hobo. And this Davies was a Welsh poet who wrote this in 1911. These lines made him famous. The thought was simple, even primitive, but somehow no one had put it quite that way before. And then she says, of course, Davies had an advantage of perception. He wasn't a tradesman or a laborer or a bureaucrat or a consultant or a policy analyst or a labor lawyer or a program manager. He was a hobo. And then she describes what she calls the cultural hero of the day, who was completely blown away by this street musician. But we don't have time to read about that. He had played the violin seriously himself, so he was attuned to the virtuosity of Bell. As it happens, exactly one person recognized Belle, and she didn't arrive till near the very end. For Stacy Furukawa, a demographer at the Commerce Department, there was no doubt. She doesn't know much about classical music, but she had been in the audience 3 weeks earlier at Belle's free concert at the Library of Congress. And here he was, the international virtuoso, sawing away, begging for money. She had no idea what the heck was going on, but whatever it was, she wasn't about to miss it. As she turned to go, she whispered to the stranger next to her, "I really don't want to leave." The stranger standing next to her happened to be working for the Washington Post. It's probably this author. Furukawa positioned herself 10 feet away from Belle, front row, center. She had a huge grin on her face. The grin and Furukawa remained planted in that spot until the end. When he stopped, Furukawa introduced herself to Belle, tossed in a 20. Not counting that, it was tainted by recognition, the final haul for his 43 minutes of paying was $32.17. Yes, some people gave pennies. "Actually, bad," Belle said with a laugh, "that's not so bad, considering. That's $40 an hour. I could make an okay living doing this, and I wouldn't have to pay an agent." All right, our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.